When and where were you born?
Edwards County, Kennel Lake, Kansas.
And what's your birth date?
13 December 1970.
And what were the names of your parents?
Hugh Miller and Ruth Peters Miller.
That was Hugh Miller and what was?
Ruth.
Ruth
Peters Miller.
Ruth Peters Miller, okay. And who were your grandparents?
Abe and Emma Peters.
Abe and what was?
Emma.
Emma Peters. And on your other side? Miller side?
Richard and Annie Miller.
Annie Miller.
Yes.
Okay. And then you started to tell us before, what brought your people to Edwards County? Was it your grandparents or parents or what?
The only recollection that I had is what my grandmother has given to me, and this is on my maternal side. She came here as a small child with her parents from Washington, D.C., on then what they called an immigrant train.
An immigrant train.
And that on that immigrant train they had the oxen, the farming equipment they were going to need on this
homestead.
And did I say 12 years old?
She was 12. Where did she come from? What country? Or were they in
America? Now they never said particular. I believe they were English.
Should be.
English. So they like my cheese. And I've often thought, now she gave me a lot of her history growing up and her education, which was more self-educated, but I graduated from a school. I'm kind of getting here to school.
That goes
on with the story. I graduated from my grade school. A mile and a half from where they her folks homestead.
And what school was that?
Hope Place. When I was there, the teacher had all eighth grade. So really we had an opportunity to get a 4-H teacher from first grade to eighth. A lot of people don't realize it. It's all them poor kids who go into a conference school. And they had eighth grade. And that teacher, we got back to hear the school. She taught first, and we got to hear the first, the second grade, and the third. It's wonder they got their own grade accomplished.
So they came out here, and did they have, like, how big was the homestead?
One quarter. And then it seemed like it, they all kind of live close by, so they could help each other.
And where was this quarter?
12 miles south, straight south.
Straight south of Kinsey.
And the reason they brought their oxen from Washington, D.C. was that he must have been a Pedro back there or murder. He had to be stripped. He had to, people who had wanted to come to campus, you got to have oxen because the Indians will feed the horses. And my grandmother said, oh, I felt so sorry today, loading up as much water to go to Canada, for the oxen took so much water for the ship to get just the supply we had at salt, flour, sugar.
You know how many days it took them to get here?
My grandmother did not know. I was just 12-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. You know. I think she done knew, or just remember she, where she came
yeah.
from. But her childhood, growing up, was very limited in what took place outside of the fact that she had to help the many neighbors. She was to help with the nursing, the dusting, laying out the dead. We had no conception what they had to put up here. We had no conception how long we can go this town back. This was a minor surprise. And they just had she always said, I knew, they don't.
Now, do you know, did they live in a
Saudi,
or did they live in
a Saudi? They lived in a Saudi. Did you tell about the flip that corn that dirt would get this ice on? But then she would tell of the experience they had with the prairie fires. But they never talked much about the production of agriculture. I think her dad must have had kind of real estate in mind when he found out because he owned the land right south of Hopewell School. All the divided his land and the school was just a road with this now 183 highway. As he amassed a lot of land. But I think in the month before he was dead, he brought there to buy it or trade for it and barter for it. They didn't have as much trade to barter for it. Because he was ending up with a lot of land. Now, my grandmother ended up with a half section of land. I didn't know earlier that I was going to get a quarter of land. She never told me she was going to give it to me. But she still wanted me to take care of the land, to be a soil conservationist. And when I was, I started riding pastures when I was 12 years old. Now, my dad had the saddle horses, and he was grazing cattle, and he was glad to see me get a horn truck to take care of the tigers. Oh, that's fine. There's a saddle horse to go. Well, I learned real well how to take care of pastures, riding fence, chicken water. First thing I done when I got back, I checked the water and sure the cattle worked. Then I rode through the fences and measured the fences. Then I went and checked my head count. Well, they got around the 12-year-old kid that got riding fences. They all they called taking care of the cattle fences, pastures, riding fences. So I'm telling you, I'm a 12-year-old fence rider.
So you were a cowboy at 12?
I was a cowboy, probably using my dad's own battles. Well, I learned that profession real well. I learned that Daniels out there. Oh, they're a miracle. I seen blowouts, and I see a little rain, here comes some grass, and I see they can heal themselves. So I said, well, hell, I'm going to send the cabinets. And I did. Oh, Lord. I became a casual trader. In those days, there was a farm, a household building, and the farm couple generally had a lot of kids. They had no cows, they had chickens. They had enough grassland to furnish grass for their power, their own power. They farmed. They didn't have tractors. They didn't buy gasoline. And the reason they got along so well during the Depression, if they had enough crop there, 3 grand for the chicken, they had meat, they had milk, and the leads, they could get town and leave you, would bring in money, they could buy their supplies, they could buy the kids' clothes, whatnot. They were more or less self-supporting. So,
now, how many were in your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Two boys and two girls. My brother was 19 months younger than I.
You're the oldest?
I was the oldest. I was the first grandchild. And then, 10 years later, there came two sisters. Today, one is 10 years younger than I am. And the other deceased. And my brother under me deceased. So
there were four of you, and now were you living next to your grandparents or on the same place or?
My grandparents, Emma and Abe Peters, bought a half a section. Now they didn't buy that. This Jim Taylor of Taylor and Son, Ed and Hugh, my grandmother's brother, he sold them a half a section of land, which was a mile from where my grandmother's folks had usually homestead. So as I told you, he accumulated all the land. So he was a land tycoon. But that is where I was raised primarily. Went to school out there in the country school.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Depression and the Dust Bowl?
I'm get this cattle raising part first. I tell you, my mother, my dad, my grandmother, it kind of, I guess you say we kept my mother and dad eventually bought the 12 miles south that my grandmother and father really were living on. So, and we've only done that, I guess, since the Taylors got about destroyed half the homesteads. We established it. I didn't read a thing about that. It's always been the family.
Now, you said the Taylors were related to you?
Yes.
Huh.
Well, my grandmother was a Taylor.
Oh, okay.
My grandmother Peters
was a Taylor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't forget, you know, grandmother's brother and the family in a cure of all lying down there. I guess they was buying them while I was riding fences. Well, anyhow, I fell in love with the San Diego grasses. That's why when I got them, I hung on to it, because people call me a fan of it and all that. But I've seen what that San Diego land grass can do. Well, good night, summer's the year round, so I became a cavalcade. He put some dignification to it. I was a cavalcade. And I trained cattle right up to the beginning of World War II. After I got out of high school, the kids were starting to talk about going to college. And I said, well, kids, I don't have to go to college. I'm going to be a cattle broker. Hell, they didn't know what broker meant in those days. But anyhow, I broke the cattle up to the beginning of World War II. People say, well, what was you doing Pearl Harbor Day? I remember exactly on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. I had 3 people hunting me, and I was building a cattle holding pen out on the east side of Kendall because I needed a place to put cattle. I'll be simple, 3 or 4, and I was taking cattle that time, it wasn't tough. But there was, well, the Loch Neagh Seal started then, but prior to the committee, there was these little country farms out there, all had no cattle, but there was no place to sell those cattle. The calves, or the old cows, it's a cattle buyer. And that was real good to me, and it was. Had to outguess the owner, which most of us got what we could, and the market for those cattle was usually the same, or at a local butcher shop. That was about the only way you could get any of livestock. So I had made because I was competing with them, old people. And they had me beat by a long way, but I didn't know it. I thought I could get it, and I could. A little bit. But they said I'm better, and they got to say, oh, a young whippersnapper. Don't know that. Well, I knew if I get a little cattle once more, I should have been saying I was doing all right.
And the cattle went on the train.
Nearly cost me my life with that gun. On December the 7th, 1941, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I had 3 or 4 guys helping build these cattle pens. And I looked up and here come my friend Arizona. And they were driving a 34 Ford. They had the doors wide open. Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Well, when they had the draft, my name was next to the last being called out. So I knew then that I didn't have to go to the war until it started, and we knew within ourselves that that war was inevitable. I listened to radio, and I read the paper quite diligently, and I knew that just the minute war was declared, I was going to have to go, but it was free hike and point along. I had a girl want to get married, and I said, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't leave a wife behind me. She said, oh, you don't know there's going to be a war. Well, I said, the hell I don't. I had a car radio at that time, and around about 11, 12 o'clock at night, we could pick up a radio broadcast station over in Great Britain, and they kept us on here how bad the war was going to be because they were involved with it. And I said, there's no way in the world we can get out of that. And lo and behold, so I told the boys, I throw those shovels down. We're going to go town and have a drink on this. Because I knew what we were doing would be wrong until the war was over. Well, as I said, and my second thing, the draft was last. And there was 12, 14 of them, I think, left in every town yet to be called. And when that, when Roosevelt declared war in the 50s, they froze everybody, the draft and all the who wanted to volunteer. There were some who were immediately going to draft on Taiwan and move on, he would take his choice. But they went much easier. So, about 2 weeks, here comes a letter from the government. We used to go to Wichita for our examination. And we used to meet up there at the hotel, at the county hospital, at the county courthouse, a certain date at 9 o'clock in the morning. So we was all up there, and we didn't know what the procedure was going to be or anything. A gentleman named Harry Johnson walked over to me.
What was that name again here?
Harry Johnson.
Johnson.
With a great big brown manila envelope, and the man said, what? You to take these boys to Wichita and take them to this location. You'll be landed 2 blocks from there, and you'll take your examinations. You'll feed them. See that they get that one high and get every one of them back here. Now, I heard many times from World War One guys, when somebody tells you something that you're affiliated with the Army, you do it. So I didn't question Mr. Johnson's command at all. I took him to Wichita, ran fed and brought him back. And then we got the letter from the government whether we had passed the examination on, and to report to the courthouse at a certain date, and which we did, and it was 3 months on each seat. So, Mr. Johnson handed me another envelope and said, I want you to take all of these. It's in here, and he said, they'd be here. And you're responsible to begin to land with. Well, I don't know how come Mr. Young picked me up, but nevertheless he did. Mr. Johnson came here from Dallas, Texas, and he was the secretary of the construction company that built the first overpass here. And he eventually married Gertrude Beer. So he was here for the past 4 years.
Now, how many people were you responsible for? How many guys?
If I can recall, I think it was 14 of us left from here. But the Greyhound Bus Company started gathering them at Syracuse, Kansas, and come this way, stopped, picked up at Lane, all the tiny Garden City, and Fortune. And there was three buses that left from here.
Who were some of the guys in that, do you remember, that are still around, or where they were from?
There were six or seven of us who left here. I couldn't remember their names. But I got them all to Leavenworth. We had settlers, a select ones. We didn't stop busing and stuff at noon. We got him Leavenworth along about 7 o'clock. The sun was down, it was dark. And do you know what? We were civilians at that time, and by 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, we were in the army. We had army clothes on. We was told up there and sleep in the barracks, make your own beds. We didn't know how to make the army bed, my goodness. And we had taken a tetanus shot, and those tetanus shots, those in those days hurt. Oh, goodness, they hurt. And we was carrying all the army clothes they had given us in barracks bags. After so, you talk about an induction. Woo!
And how old were you?
I was young, 26, 27.
But you were you older than the other guys, or were you about all the same?
I was a little bit older. Yeah. I had old hair then. But my goodness, this is the army life. And I don't know why, but I've never been a pusher. I've been a little fence rider out there and kind of hand wagging and let the drivers go ahead. But they kept a picking on me. And I was one of the first to meet Corporal. I was one of the well, after I made Corporal, wasn't much of a stick to make sergeant. And then I made tech sergeant. Very soon, I made master sergeant, and before I left, I was first sergeant. And my first assignment when I got overseas was Company L of the 19th Infantry.
And where were you?
Oahu, Hawaii. We were the first draftees over there. After the war. And you know what? If the Japanese had as good of intelligence for the Army as they had with the Navy, I don't know. You and I wouldn't be sitting there talking today. Because they walked through and took Oahu, Well, no, we had to, and why, I don't know. Bill, barbed wire and tangle over along all those coasts, around Wahoo. Because there was no defense, not one. Kennedy got more defense than Wahoo at that time. Well, the Japanese had them, we just walked through.
So you put the barbed wire on the coast, all the way around?
18 hours a day. We had training camp all over Texas. They give us good basic training. But I guess the biggest surprise in the Army was when I walked out and started training at Camp Wall, Texas, on an hand-trained gun. Now, this
hand-trained
and anti-tank.
Anti-tank.
Now, let's see. This is the 8th of March. This is in April of 1942. The war has been declared about 7 months. They come day a toy. I said to myself, a toy. The IDF Army is training on toys. You know what? That's as much plain that our infantry had made at that particular time. Now they had pretty good airplanes. They had pretty good high artillery, but we didn't have any infantry training. And we had very, very few weapon force, you know. And when we was going through this thing over in Wahoo, we all kind of scared because just not knowing what we were going through. My goodness. But the United States Army sent, I forget the regiment, or not the regiment, the Army, but obviously the regiment, yeah. I think it was about the, well, I won't say, cemetery, over the Guadalcanal. And they was using World War I tactics. And how they got the kids killed right and left. So when we got to Wahoo, we had good basic training. We helped build the fortifications for Wahoo, where at least they would have a chance to defend themselves. And we had built some defenses, artillery on there. They shipped us to Australia, and for another 8 weeks, we were retrained on tactics to fight the Japanese, because we didn't want to go through another one for now. At that time, MacArthur thought, well, we will do this. We were in Australia taking basic training again, how to fight the Japanese. We were in defense of Australia because they had no defenses. And so had the Japanese hit the Australian coast, the 24th Division would have been in support of him. But MacArthur was by, he would, leapfrog an island and Frog and Castrol deputies. Then he go to another island. Leapfrog. He leapfrogged there, and that's why I was in, that's why my outfit was in the 1, 2, 3, 4 first wave in. We all over the game. Our rubber slab was in Hovelandia. That's the day of the Philippines. And then we were in the first wave in Luzon, which is the Philippines. I cracked up after a bad battle over in the Philippines. And when you crack that valley, they had chronology for it. They call it psychocerosis. You have lost your marbles. Well, when we got back to the hospital, the next morning the doctor come up and looked at the chart and said, psychoneurosis. And he scratched that and said, battle. I think we need to go back to the States. I don't want to go back to the States. I want to go back to my outfit. What? I said, I want to go back to my outfit. Well, then you're going to be here for a while anyway. So, the second night I was there, the Japanese come over and bomb the hospital. And they had incendiary bombs that were dropping. Since it's on fire, they were dropping little pipes about 4 inches long, big around 3/4. And they were filled with phosphorus. And that phosphorus burned to 1,700 degrees, just kind of like an airfield. Well, they dropped one of those right over there, the stretch that I was laying on. And by one up above on the show, that pieces hit the arm of that stretcher and bounced away. If they had bounced to the come on little, that's one of the dogs come over and says, you want to go back to the outfield? Yep. Part of that hole was so careful and burbled that it wouldn't burn. And just kind of be out where it hit you. Well, anyhow, I laid there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. Finally broke the fever. And he asked me a third time, do you want to go back? Yep. Okay, I have to sign the order for you. So I went back, and you know, I didn't know anybody in the company. But walked in the company commander. He said, oh, you're from the hospital. He said, we're there looking for you. He said, you're my new first sergeant. I give it time to go with the shock. And I said, I don't know anybody that is that much the best help for service. So I prefer God get up until I was relieved from having to do. Got back there to the disc debarkation place. They said, you have 2 ways to go home. You can go home by plane, but you'll have to wait for 30 days, or you can go home by ship and move tomorrow. I said, I'll take the ship because I know we'll be here before 30 days. And we got on a brand new ship, Ernest T. Hines. All this slick as could be. And we get out of the way from, I think we shipped out of, well, I don't really know, the Grimsboro, somewhere in the Philippines. We got out about 3 days and a damn ship broke down. They had to get a tub to come out from a, what they call Burns Island. And Burns Island was an island that they had taken over to repair the ships that got a shop or something like that. And we sat there for 3 or 4 days to park to that. And we didn't go on once they got but that great big new motor, you know, which wasn't put together. And we was out on their way for about 1 day from Burn Island. This was all a big camp down there. And the the PA system, they want to know if there's anybody in there. You got to run a certain kind of ice cream machine. And the kids knew it. One of the sailors so said, yeah, I know how to run one. Well, they come in, the captain wants to see you. So he gets up there, and the captain finds out he can operate this ice cream machine. And he held back in about 30 minutes or maybe an hour, and he said, boy, you're going to have ice cream for the guest ice cream. And he said, guess what it's going to be? Well, nobody got to tell him, yes, everything. He kept tomato ice cream. And he said, they've got more tomato juice on this ship than I was on my life. And we've got enough to make ice cream all the way. And you know, of course, we hadn't had ice cream for 3 years, something like that. And it was beyond that. The best tasting ice cream I ever had. And he had made, that's the biggest, best ice cream maker I ever saw in my life. I don't know how many dollars that thing cost. And he said, that makes all the ice cream that anybody on this board should produce. We had ice cream for breakfast. Of those barbed wire and guns, they were the best guns I ever saw in hell barbed wire. If you think I could ever find a pair of my gun back, I don't know how come the government just pulled us off. But they sure is, because we had surplus everywhere. I made $1,000 handling that surplus everywhere. But they never had any good.
Now, when did you come home? When was the ship? What year, month or year? Did you say 3 years? Was it 45?
I was overseas 40, 7 months. And never had a quilt.
So that's 4 years, just about.
Never had a quilt. Those draftees, they got sent with me overseas. Where I was picking the regular army. Now, we had been overseas about, I guess, over 2 years, and the government said, do we have a new program? If you have served overseas for 24 months, you shall be rotated back to the States for 38 furlough, and then we'll ship you back to your regular army. Well, we were also happy to hear that, but by being the Red Army, we were some guys been over this for 36 months, 46 months. One old Sergeant Morley been over there for I don't know how many years. He was serving two or three years of bad time for contact and gonorrhea over in China. He rolled it off with a cane. So, you know, there goes rotation. And so I can remember very vividly some guy had been overseas 40 months, 42 months, rotating. And there I was, I've been just under them, I've been months. I can tell you the truth. When this ship got, I think one day outside of Pearl Harbor, they come across the radio that they were going into Pearl Harbor, and those who lived on the west side of the Rocky Mountains would get off, and those who lived on the other side of the Rocky Mountains would go to New York. And I was going to go to New York. So I got to go to the Panama Canal, and we was outside the Panama Canal. We just went through. We was outside the Panama Canal. I'm gonna say 6 hours. So I first seen all the lights come up. What in the world happened? Well, we knew that the atomic bomb had been dropped on
Hiroshima.
Yeah, pretty much I can say. But we knew that take place. But we knew when those lights come on, something had big happened. And sure enough, the war was cessation. So that was August the 13th, wasn't it? Yeah, August the 13th. So I got to go through New York Harbor. That means I left the West Coast. I saw the bottom of the Golden Gate Bridge come out and debark New York Harbor. I see the Statue of Liberty. Went to Camp Josh Kilmer. They said you can, well, that night we put in Camp Josh Kilmer. They said, now you boys is getting back from overseas. You can have all the beer you want. You can have all the steak you want. Anything you want, you can have. It's your meal. Oh, beer, steak, you bet. I was able it happened fast as this. And I couldn't, I didn't know that I opened up. A German prison serving Camp Joyce, someone, Camp Joyce killed me. He's one of the trees, isn't he? Mm-hmm. I said, oh, see?
Yeah.
They had that camp name after him. And these German prisoners would take the order, and they hadn't learned English pretty well. And I would, I can sure eat an AF steak. Well, I just was able to, that's all. And I had a glass of beer. And then I got back to Kansas City.
How did you get back here, by train? Or?
Come from Kansas City to here by plane.
By plane?
Not plane, but train. What the hell's wrong with it? Train.
Were there a lot of soldiers on the train?
Yes, a lot of soldiers on the train, lots of them. I remember one lady, how well I remember her. Now, we were told that door, of course, the lady was home with cigarettes, no such stockings, no booze. Well, I did them poor things. So I had about 10 or 15 cartons of cigarettes in my baggage bag. And they cost me $4 and a half a carton. No taxes on them. But the service man on them, bombing from the Navy. And I had any kind of cigarettes you want. I'm just listening, and she thought, I said, they tell me you haven't got cigarettes back here. They say, oh, we don't. And I said, what time you for? Oh, camels. You got camels? I said, yeah, I'll go get you back to camels. And I went and got back to camels on my birthday. I said, here. It didn't cost me the outside of 30 cents, something like that. And I don't know. She had to go to the restroom or something, but she had a purse. She left it open a little door and saw it. And she had bags of camel cigarettes. I thought, of all the bad names I could call her. But that was my first association with the Sumerian. And my mother and Bert Lewis and his wife Thelma met me at the depot, and I come home on the, what they call the Dougal Road, from noon. Took the passenger train out of Kansas City and got on the Dougal Road. And I looked at Main Street. I just hadn't seen one bit. But I went all through that war. I told Foster's bomb about getting me. And I was shot at point blank by a little Japanese that I looked. Yeah, about 12 years old, they must have been 15 or 16. He was shooting my head, and he was shooting my chest like a sherbet. Carl G. Bussell, for Walden, Arkansas, was my runner. And I had lost my platoon leader, so I was taking charge of the platoon. I went into that battle with about, I had practically full three squads. So, Carl G, if he don't get in this time, he's going to get me. Yeah, I hear that shot. Well, those two times, do you think I couldn't even get a scratch? And I heard bullets go by me, I don't know how many times. That limb's caught on top of my head. Of course, I was trained real long. And when you were supposed to get down, I got down. And I guess that's why I'm using the shooting out of the mouth.
Now, was there any kind of a celebration when you came home, or
Very little. The celebration when they yourself.
What did your family do, or what did you do? How did you celebrate?
Well, I guess I'll just tell you a story about my wife. I saw her about a month before the war was declared, just something like that. But I knew that she was going to marry one of these stations up north here. I said, what the? That cute girl, wouldn't you want to marry that no cowbastard anymore? That's what I thought. So why can't you say? Well, nonetheless, that was then. And so, Ophir, they had their annual, I guess it was a Columbus Day celebration. And I went over there with Bus Thumbin, and here was the girl's mother, I should say, now with two boys. I said, there she was with Virginia Dulcek. So, Boston got back from the army, I think, two or three months, and hey, me, we go over there. Kind of sad, isn't it? And he said, well, there's that girl, that Dulcek girl there. There's that Gleason girl there. Let's go and see them here, baby. Well, I was all for it. I hadn't seen one of them in quite a while. To be close to one at least, after I won the hook on the cigarettes. So we went over and I introduced myself, he knew Virginia Dulcek, and he hadn't met Murray Gleason, so we all introduced. We made her date that night with him. I don't guess I ever, I had a girl that wanted to get married, not to see before the war. I guess, Marie took my eye. She was right there in the right of both. The other one lived 90 miles from here.
Did you say that her husband, was she divorced or he died? Or
she divorced.
She divorced. That would little unusual.
Oh, yes, and she was so scared to death that wouldn't want to be seen with her because of the fact that she was that divorce was paid the penny, and from the background of her and the Gleasons all were together. But nevertheless, to make a long story short, Bus married Virginia Dulcek, and I married Murray Gleason.
That took a little while. Were you engaged or dated?
I went with her for two or three years. I went with her long enough, I was embarrassed.
Was that your fault or hers?
when I asked her to marry me, she said yes right fast. I told you a lot,
Just a sec. Let's see here. Eject. Put this thing over. Okay.
And I told you, start with because her husband, dad was Tom Gleason. And Tom Gleason, I respected him just tremendously, but he was such a gentleman, a fine man. But this son, he was a no-grass OB, in my opinion, and hers too, for that matter. Well, he damn near beat her to death last time. That's when she got the divorce. But here I was, wild-ass cowboy. And Mary Grass with two boys. Come to think about it, the old boy took my job, boy.
Seemed to work out.
After 50 years, 60 years, after marriage, all the way through, for a long time we never even had an argument. What I think our marriage is supposed to be face to face again. And I knew an old codger like me ought to at least go 50%. And I did. And it worked. It worked.
Now, did you have any problems when you came home from the war with dealing with your war experience? And
yes, I can talk about it now. I can talk about it now. I had one shoe that scared me all through, I guess, 20 years. I didn't talk about that at first. I went to a picture show. It was Marie. And I don't know, very shortly after I got back. And a plane came over. Didn't show a face and the fatter of the seats. Just well, plane, that's Grimbo. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been twice once in the service. But I'm telling you, that's the experience. You can't begin to explain. Instantaneously. Oh, yeah. Television, there's no cover for it. There's no cover for it. And I always took good care of my man. I had this one kid and always kept, get down. And I told him to get down, and he didn't get down, and he got sick. And when he died in my arms, he said, Sergeant, I should have died down. But I didn't have to have any psychiatrist. I kept thinking what that doctor said over there in the Philippines. Well, you go when I need you to go. So I was the cattle raider when I got back.
Let me ask you one more question. Did your brother go in the service?
He went in the Navy shortly after he graduated from high school. And he stayed in the Navy all through the war. He was discharged out there during the war.
What theater was he in? In the Pacific?
Pacific. Mm-hmm. Well, I come home and came, well, right in the trading cattle. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot different then and today. The cattle had to be seized and ordered by it, because you can't trade much. And the markets that we went to in Kansas City, and we sold to the pack houses, those pack houses now are out here. They're liberal. They're Garden City, home, Dutch City.
Your dad started the sale pavilion?
Yeah.
And that was before the war. Did you help him start the sale pavilion?
I worked at the sale pavilion. I made acquaintance at the sale barn with an old Colonel Sims, P.C. Sims. And he and I were good buddies. And he knew that I was a sand rat. And after the war, very shortly after, I don't remember how many months, they walked up, they said, "Jack, come here, man." He said, "I bought you a pasture." "Well, I've got money in my pasture." He said, "Well, you better find it, because I bought you one." He said, "Come back tomorrow, I want to talk to you. Come down, come down." He had a bank, under the old bank building. On the south side of the Main Street. And I was down there. He told me what place he bought and what cost. And I said, "Oh, I don't know how I can swing it." He said, "Well, you go find a way or something, because you got a buck." Well, my mother had sold her property out west, so my dad had bought through the war. My brother and I went there and looked at the property, and my goodness, it was 35 miles right through the north side of Colorado, and that was about 12 miles west, where the government put all the Japanese
things in. Return camp.
Absolutely. I said, "Well, I remember things. I chased all around the jungles over there, and I didn't know who he was. He was going to have equipment or not. I just don't want you to come out here. I'm not interested in this place at all." I told him that. "That's not for us out there." So she sold that, and then after the colonel bought this grassland, I said, "Mom, maybe we buy half of that and I'll buy it." So my mother and I parted in that Charlie Smith place. Right? About 5 miles straight from Kinley. It's lay on both sides of the highway. There was 1,300 and some acres there. So then I said, "Well, I got the pasture and I got my ranch. Got a wife."
Got two boys.
Got my boys.
And that's what we call, that's the house is still there?
Yeah.
It's right on the curb.
Yeah.
To be sure I knew where I was at.
Yeah, I bet that I bought a house and moved in there. Yeah. That's because the tornado hit and tore the barn down. Yeah. Well, that just about covers my life and all of that side of all parts that I'm not proud of.
Well, that's all right. That's your right. We've got a couple other questions, I think. Rosetta had one from going back. When you left on the bus to go to Leavenworth, Did the town give you any kind of a send-off or anything? Or did you just quietly get on and go?
Oh, no, I never got a gathering. Oh, I'm not. A couple hundred people at the gift. No band, but all the people, all well wishers.
All your families and.
My family and everything goodbye.
And.
Yeah, right. They had two boys, both of them in the service. And the operation was out of no help with the war. People home had rough.
How did it affect your mother and the family
having
the men folk
over? My dad was a bigger candidate of the war than both of these things. He died when he was 46. My mother was left there with a farm and a restaurant, two girls. And have that business in Colorado. And she had rough ones, and my dad, I know that by having said and having his two sons in the service, and all the help I got about when his dad was down there. Heart problems.
What year did he die?
No, I don't.
Was it during the war?
No, yes.
So the strain, you think, caused an early death, maybe?
I don't know it did. Because he just knew, well, it was, this is what not knowing the truth detail, that he was told that the army was going to make a bombing target out of his pasture. See? And he knew they had to do his pasture.
Who told him that?
Well, it was just the talk.
Rumor.
Because I don't know, I wasn't here. But the rumor was that the bombing pasture was going to kick some pasture. Well, the bombing pasture did kick some pasture, but they didn't take it. But the rumor ruined his pasture, and two sons, and there was no help.
Now, did they actually, was it close to Kinsley, where they actually used pastures for bombing?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Five hours.
Just by the river.
On the south river, yeah.
This is strange for this whole thing. Is there anything else you want? I think we've pretty much done anything. Let's, one question we were sort of just exploring, which really has nothing to do, but during this time period of the war and shortly after, we were just interested in how the relationship of the Hispanic and the black community. Did you have any?
Oh, I was in the war when Harry Truman said what did I want to find it on? Come England. When they put the black and white together.
Integrated,
that's right. Personally, that didn't bother me at all. Still like it. I've seen Charter Post won a good friend. They got one right. I was in charge of a compartment coming back from overseas, all black. They were rougher on their own than we were, but I also saw that the Deep South resent. They even hate it today. I was in Mississippi one day. Well, I saw them down there. They're so born. I saw a little tray right there in the lawn. I'd go in and get a cup of coffee and start just the inside and tell the tap on my back and I'd turn around and the guy pointed the sign. Blacks only. What the hell is this kid down here? I buy but sign. Oh, you call it down in the black cafe. What the hell wrong with that?
Well, you had blacks in your class in school, and
I went to school with lots of games, and Bill games, and Howard games. But you know, I'd go down to Mississippi, which I did, and told them I went to school with colored kids. Oh, you didn't. And hell, that was prevalent. I'm known, of course, time gets away from me, but 10 or 15 years ago, I bought a lot of cattle in Mississippi. I couldn't buy 350-pound calves here, because the calves got to be in Edwards County weighing 4.5 and 5.5. Now they weigh 6.5. I can buy those 3.5 what I used to buy in Mississippi. They're getting smart too, yeah. Now they're 350-pound calves after the 450-pound calves. But I don't know. I just sit here one time. Of course, I kind of knew cattle, at least I thought I did. That those calves are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I said, I'm going to go someplace and find some white calves. I happened to see an ad in the Livestock Weekly. It was printed in San Angelo, Texas. And so in their Mississippi Oilers. I called them, who was what I wanted, and you come down. So I flew down. I done business with Mississippi Oil Buyers, I guess, for 10 or 15 years. Melvin went down there because of my being acquainted down there. He was down there 5, 6, 7 years. Yeah. So I sold my last limited cattle. Been 3 years ago. They bring, that's me, bring 110, 50, 100. That means a 1,000-pound crew bring $1,010. And the last 5 cattle I sold. Bring $47.50. Those same cattle today would bring $85.50. So I saw my dad sell fat cattle for $375. I thought, and that's a hell of a lot, 47.75. But they have sold that same cattle. I was selling 47.75, finally bring 102 or 103 yards, 100. So I see from the top to the bottom.
Okay, just a couple other things. that World War II affected your life? How did it, good, bad, or, I mean, what did it do to you personally? Can you think?
Yes, I never have given it thought. I made a lot of bad deals and I found out, but
I mean, here you were a Kansas boy and went off, you know, across the ocean and
I've been around the world. I've been around the world. I tell you what, I've seen wind over in Africa. Pick up kernels of wheat with the finger. All right, cancer. They said, well, think about this. A day full and get a handful. I feel I must stay on the road in a hard time. I've been around the world, but I saw the Golden Gate, northeast, and I've been over, been on top, saw the Statue of Liberty. I've been in Africa, all over the Philippines, all over New Guinea, and Australia.
Does that change you, having seen the world? Did you change?
I tell you why I found out. I worked for John Lund, the only man I ever worked for, really. I'll tell you myself. He came from Sweden. And I asked one time, what in the world ever possessed you to come to Edwards County? I mean, we got filmed there. I took care of 807 head for that 1 year. And I guess that's when I asked him this. He said, why? All the good water was right down there. He said, you could buy a 22-foot piece of pipe, and he said, you can get all the good water you want for your cattle. Here I am, 91 years old, and that conversation took place. What difference does it make? We know it was a long time ago. And I can still remember that conversation. Look what water has done for a little child. I'll tell you what. In my travels, I've never seen a place that I like them better than we can. I can't explain to you four sessions, four terms. Secretary of the Kennedy Co-op. When I come out of the service and I saw what the service was doing to men overseas, I mean the first night I was in Schofield Barracks, that's in Wally, Honolulu. Had no one got to sleep, and I heard the most hideous scream in the world. And I would jump up and fell right next to the wall. I said, don't pay attention to that. I said, pay attention to that hell. You scared me to death. All I say happened every 2 or 3 months. So the next morning, I said, point this guy out to me, just doing all the screaming. great big old fellow over there. Had a great big fellow, 6 foot, 3 or 4, weighed 200 or 400 pounds out for it. He weighed 300 pounds. And he had jumped and run into a car and killed his wife and 2 kids. And he would think of that every once in a while. He didn't scream. Well, I saw numerous guys. They didn't have that wrong with something wrong with them. And these were regular army guys that had used the regular army to get away from the stuff, the psychological stuff. I mean, my gosh, these guys, what are they going to do when they get back home? It's hard telling. I know, I knew. So when I come home, they were talking about the VFW. And that just sounded good to me. Better than the foreign wars. And you had to be overseas, you didn't know. So I said, that'd be good to start talking to some of those veterans. They sure need the help. My gosh, in a matter of 6 years, I was department commander of Kansas. They had about 30,000 veterans in the various VFW posts on Kansas. So,
and what, how did you see the VFW helping these guys?
The Special Services, Veterans Administration, doctors, various hospitals. Now we got this Voice of Democracy, all the young kids supporting this, that, and this. Oh, there's a lot of various programs we got. Of course, I'm seeing this too. The troops returned not as they don't view the services like we do.
How did you view them? What's the difference?
Well, like I said, see, I remember by far these guys were there over there, 9 months? They get paid. Give back to safe. Give back to them. They got a lot of girls in the service now. I saw the nurses. I tell you what, I'm ready to go on because I don't fit in the psychology of the LMJ government, the countries, age-wise, speed-wise. I'm a 55-mile-an-hour man on the highways.
So the VFW that you helped start here in Kansas, you saw that as a way to help fellas that had some problems and to get reintegrated into the community? And
yep.
And I suppose there was a brotherhood there.
Very much so. Very much so.
So I can look this up in our records, but the post was started about when here? Would it have been a year or two after, or sooner than that?
It was being formed right after the war. It was an old one because they had started one in World War I.
Oh, okay, so it was just...
But they had kind of more or less petered out. Now, like, I'm going to think maybe World War II petered out. But the younger veterans, they don't have... Well, like I said, they're going more on their own. Now, they're going to have government programs, but I'm not acquainted. I'm inactive. I've got a lot of members,
right.
But I'm inactive, so why do I know what the programs are now? I'm sure they got a lot of good ones.
Okay, well, the last question is, how do you think World War II affected Edwards County? Of course, we didn't really talk a lot about the Dust Bowl and stuff before, but what changes came as a result of World War II, do you think, the county?
I don't think World War II changed the country as much as this human tradition. Now, I can remember people talking about the population is 130 billion now. Can you imagine? No, I can't imagine it. But now, of course, we haven't seen the new census. But we're thinking it may be 300 million.
Did the population stay the same here in Edwards County after the war, or did it start to decline?
I couldn't answer as to the number, but I can tell you the businesses we got in Kinley are able to take care of our population. We didn't need 6 car dealers in Kinley. We didn't need 5 grocery stores. We would like a good drive-through store. We didn't need, of course, the jobs. We got good highways. We can drive 65 miles an hour in a good car.
Did the guys you knew and went to school with, did they come back here and live in Kinsley after the war? No. What did they do?
They saw how other boys various parts of the country, and I can remember one in my class. It was, he loved the outdoors and hunting and fishing, and he found hunting and fishing to his satisfaction in Washington State, but he was there in the army. Some of them got. Well, they had the Army put them here and there, and the Navy put them here and there. And the reason I come back here is because I like Samuel.
You had the land.
Well, I got the land. I had the friend that got the land, I said, I got it. And the one. Now, I put one of the first irrigation systems. I didn't put it in for full production. I put it in so I would have feed for my cat. Oh, the ducks want to go for full production. Raised to go and bust the corn. I said, hell, I don't want to kill a bush of corn. I can't have a machine. I don't want a machine. I'm not a progressor, I'm a degressor. I tell you what caused me to quit. I didn't quit in time, but I couldn't get on my saddle horse.
You couldn't get on what?
My saddle horse.
Your saddle horse.
Couldn't tow my leg. And the last thing I sold at my paddock auction was myself. I said, you need to smoke because you can't use it. So that's when I really gave up. But I said, I'll keep them pastures until I'm gone. So that's why I'm operating today under the trust. I won't ever sell them bacon. I trust them. They can do whatever they want to. But I want to keep that water and grass as long as I'm alive, I hope.
Okay, I think, boy, this is...